Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Eyes Free Sports Podcast. Once again, this is your host, Greg Lindberg, here with you. On this episode, we take a little detour away from blind sports as a competition, and instead we have a guest join us who is currently the only totally blind broadcaster in the 4 major professional sports in the U.S. We have Enrique Oliu with us, who is the longtime member of the Tampa Bay Rays Spanish radio broadcast team. Enrique, thanks so much for joining us.
Greg, thank you for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be on your show, as we would say. It's always a pleasure to share my life and share the story, and because I think maybe somebody is motivated to do something.
Yeah, hey, I appreciate that. Alrighty, so I'd like to just kind of go in chronological order here, just about your life, your achievements, and whatnot. So I understand that you were born in Nicaragua originally, correct?
That's correct. I was born in the town of Matagalpa, Nicaragua, in 1962, and the only blind person in my family. Dad didn't really know what he had. At that time there was no ADA here for sure, but less there. So they had to figure out what they were going to do. I mean, it's very difficult. Usually the firstborn is the one that's going to carry the mantle, and they weren't sure how it was going to happen. But, in 1962, I was born, and then life, as we would say, went on from there.
And I understand that it was because you were a premature baby. Is that kind of what caused your vision issue?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I see. And is that like
very small?
Right. Is that retinopathy of prematurity then? That's the actual diagnosis?
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. And then, so then you did move to, was it Costa Rica?
Yes, at the age of 5. They sent me to boarding school.
I see.
Because there weren't any schools for me in Nicaragua.
Really?
They had tried the public school, not the public school, because all the kids that had a couple bucks went to private Catholic school, but they tried to send me to the Catholic school, and the poor nuns just didn't know how to teach anyone that had, visually disability, that was visually impaired. So mom kept looking, and she found one place in Central America, which was the blind school in Costa Rica, School for the Deaf and Blind.
And would you say across, say, South America in general, Central America, are there very few? Is it limited as far as services and education for the blind?
It's gotten better, but it's still very limited.
Really?
Somebody did a piece on me last year on Telemundo, and they went and filmed at the school in Costa Rica, and it was really sad for me to see the pictures, the images come back, how in disrepair it is.
Wow.
And I guess probably they're trying to mainstream them now. And Nicaragua's gotten better. There is a blind school now, which is a good thing. But it's still a long ways to go compared to what we have here, especially the Florida school. It's way behind.
So then I understand it was around the age of 10 when you actually moved to Florida and started at the Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind, correct?
That's correct. What happened with that was that the blind school in Costa Rica only went to 6th grade. So you had to figure out where to go after that. I mean, was it to do basket weaving or do some woodworking or do something, or play an instrument or what have you. So as it turned out, while they were taking me to all these eye doctors around the U.S., we didn't go home to Nicaragua in one of those trips right away. We stopped to see my aunt, who lived here in Florida, and she said, well, one of the best schools for the blind are here in the state of Florida. It's amazing. So, okay, take them up there. So they took me up there, and, I didn't care about the school per se, what they were going to teach me. All I care is about the structure facilities, the 2 indoor pools, the nice dorms, the, nice beds, a lot of open fields where you could play.
Yeah.
And do things. And so they took me up there. They liked what they saw, and I liked what I saw. 2 indoor heated pools, and talk to the man, and that the admissions person, the principal, and the student life director. And we didn't go right away. We came home, and then had to apply and see how we're going to get in there. And the first year, we were able to scrunch up some money, and it was $5,000 to go to the school. But then my aunt became a legal guardian, and I could go for free after that. But the first year was $5,000, which in 1972, 73 was a lot of money.
Yeah, no question.
So that's how I got there to the school.
I see. And if you could just kind of talk about that experience, and I understand they do offer, you know, different sports and recreation for the children that attend that school as well.
It's not as much, but I love when I went there, it was. Hmm. You know, we played kickball, we played t-ball, we did gymnastics. The pool was open a lot of times during the week. For PE, they don't have as much PE now because of all the rules, you know, all the Gordon Rule things, you know, you have to keep yourself accredited where you have to take this many credits. So right. We don't have gym every year. We had gym every day, every year when I went there. So for me, when I got there, it was great. We would do a month of everything, you know, a month of, well, we'll start with physical fitness, how, you know, physically fit you were. You would do the 50-yard dash, pull-up sit-ups, push-ups and all that. And then you would get into the fun part where you would play 1 month or whatever sport. You would play 1 month of kickball, softball. You would play 1 month of football, you know, would adapt it. Like, you would have to holler if you had the ball, or they would adapt it on mat football. Then you would go indoors and do the gymnastics thing, where you would have to spot on the trampoline and, you know, do the parallel bars and all that. And the next month you would have swimming. You know, you would have all swim. But now, before you did all these sports, you have to watch the tape. Let's say you were doing the football unit, as they would call it. Well, you have to watch the Vince Lombardi, one of those tapes that he had done way back in the 60s, Football Is, or whatever it is, you know, where he taught football on the tape.
Yeah, yep.
And so you would learn about the theory of the game, whether it's, you know, gymnastics. You would watch a clip of Olga Corbett, and they would walk you through Olga Corbett, you know, what she did for the floor exercises or what have you. Or, you know, let's say we were doing track, they would explain to you what the Flossberry flop was, and they would, you know, walk you through it, and things like that. So to me, it was great.
Yeah, so it sounds like they definitely had a lot of, and I assume they made some adaptations, you know, to some of the activities and whatnot, so that blind or visually impaired with any kind of sight could do these things.
Yeah, or no, well, the sighted kids could run and hit it, but for us, they would put the ball on the tee. They would run to the bases, you know, run with us to the bases. You would holler if you had the ball, you know, for football. You know, in swimming, you have the lane, so it's not a big deal. And then for the trampoline, you had all these guys around the trampoline. Though I don't know, some of those guys were pretty big. I'm glad I didn't have to catch anybody.
Yeah.
But so we would get walked, you know, somebody would walk us through. And we were kind of adventurous too. One of my friends thought he wanted to run do the hurdles, because, you know, when we're doing the track unit, it was during track season. So all the track stuff was set up there, you know, on the track and so forth. And he mismeasured, the poor guy mismeasured, and almost tore up his leg.
Oh, jeez.
But, you know, it's a lot of fun to do, you know, do the broad jump, do the long jump, to run the different distances on the track. So they would teach you all this stuff, you know, adapted. Like you would for track, if you were running, either they ran with you or they would put the bike in front of you and throw a rope behind it, and you would hold on to the rope.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. You know, just some pretty simple adaptations can really go a long way. Just
yes.
Simple things, yeah.
For wrestling, you know, let's say wrestling, you just have to, it's still the same thing. You have to maintain contact with somebody. You can't, you know, once you break contact, the match is kind of, you know, paused, stopped. And you would have to start at the previous position wherever you were.
Right.
So, you know, things like that. Very simple adaptations.
I see. And did you have, you know, growing up, did you have like a favorite sport that you really enjoyed playing, for example?
No, I liked them all because we were able to play all of them. And I liked them all. I liked anything that competed. It was a lot of fun.
Right.
You know, whether it's cards, whether it was, you know, pool, I never really got into that, but some of my friends did. What didn't matter, you just wanted to compete.
No doubt, yeah. I'm also curious, as far as FSDB goes, the interaction between the visually impaired and the deaf children that attend that school. Did you get to interact at all with other deaf children?
Well, yes. Fortunately for me, since I was a wrestler, the team was mixed. It was in the beginning when I got there, there was a blind team and a deaf team, but then they merged them. And so from the standpoint of that, we did the team together. And then a friend of mine was an assistant softball coach for the women's and, you know, like that. But and the football team was mixed. And I had one of my roommate was an offensive lineman for the football team. So got to, you know, meet some of those guys, but we didn't interact too much. They were like to the front of the campus, and we were in the back of the campus closer to the water. Even their snack, their bowling alley, they had their own bowling alley. We had ours. Hmm. They had their snack bar. We had ours. So it wasn't much at that point. It's gotten a lot better with Dr. Prickett at the helm. That, you know, everybody seems to go to Dragon's Lair. Everybody seems to, you know, mingle amongst the deaf, you know, the blind kids and the deaf kids. And I think they're taught sign language. You know, really? As one of their subjects.
Yeah, yeah. That really is interesting. And then as far as graduating, was it, were you 18 then when you did complete your schoolwork there?
Yes, I was.
Oh, I see. And then talk to me about, you know, upon graduation, what did you actually embark on immediately after that?
Well, immediately I went home to Nicaragua on vacation, and then I needed to polish up some skills, so I went to the, it's called the Conklin Center now, but it was just a Daytona Rehab Center where they run you through a different, you know, polishing up, whether it's English, math, whatever, getting you ready to take the ACTs or whatever test to get into class. And, you know, to get into college and, you know, teach you personal finance, arts and crafts, whatever, to polish up some stuff. And so I went there and then started looking for a college. And my parents who control my grandfather's kind of a trust fund thing that he had left me, because my grandfather thought, since I was the only disabled kid in the family, that I was going to be way behind the eight ball. Hmm. So he left me as a full share, along with his kids, you know, my three aunts and my dad and my uncle. So they, my parents control the thing. So they sent me, and I started looking for, we started looking for schools. They did not like HCC. They didn't like any of those big schools USF.
Right.
I come from, you know, the blind school, which, yes, it was very small, and you get a lot of attention. They did send me to the regular high school on a pilot program, where whoever they thought could do something with themselves, go to college or do something, they would send them to the regular public school, St. Augustine High, and do the subject matter and, you know, get a feel for how it's going to be to get your readers, get everything.
Yep.
So I did that. So, but anyway, so while I was in Daytona, my parents started looking for college. My mother was starting to get frustrated because she didn't like HCC. She didn't like the shorts. She didn't like the long hair. She thought it was just like, ugh. You know, coming from a conservative Latino family, that kind of stuff back then in 1980, that didn't attract her at all.
Yeah.
So my uncle and my aunt, going back to my aunt, who was my legal guardian, well, my uncle and aunt had lived in Tampa for, I don't know, 15, 17 years. And he did a lot of work in Temple Terrace. And he came home and told Mom, well, have you even looked at this place called Florida College? Nice little school in Temple Terrace. I think it would be pretty good there. So I remember Mom calling me, and he says, well, we found this little school. I think it's good that people are dressed tight. You know, they dress neat. They have to go to chapel. They have to, you know, very strict and so forth. I know you might not like it because some of the things are silly, such as Bible class and so forth. I said, oh, I'm going there. I don't know. But I got there, and everybody took me in, staff, the kids. And we became friends with all these kids. To this day, I'm still very good friends with all these people. You know, I have lifetime friends with people who I met at Florida College. And they kind of gave me the foundation, religious or otherwise. And so I went to the school, the same thing, you know, small school, 20, 30 people for class. So you still could get attention. You had to show up for class. You couldn't skip. And they would take roll. And you had to get up because you had to go to chapel every day. So
yeah.
Everything, you know, you had to be dressed. You had to, you know, you couldn't be looking disheveled there. Everything was, you know, very strict, very up, very neat. So that's how I got to Florida College. My parents said, try it for 1 year, and then if you don't like it, we'll put you somewhere else. And as it turned out, I liked it. So I, you know, got an AA degree, got the Dean's Award from there, and then I went to USF. But that's how it happened. That wow. I ended up at Florida College, this little school on the banks of the Hillsborough River.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. And I'm curious, going to USF, obviously a much larger school, even back then.
Basic economic. One of my classes, though, I was a communications major. I always enjoyed taking hard stuff like macro and microeconomics. And I remember sitting in microeconomics in this big room, big auditorium for about 300 people.
That was something. Intimidating.
Where the teacher says, I don't care if I'm doing anything or not. You better make an appointment to come see me. Because if you don't have an appointment, I'm not going to see you. So, all of a sudden you go, huh? What's that? I'm used to going and walking in if they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
But fortunately, a lot of people have took me under the wing, again, from Florida College. They went to USF and they took me in and they helped me out reading or drawing stuff and other stuff.
And then as far as broadcasting goes, when did you kind of know that that was an interest of yours and that was something you did want to pursue?
Well, I loved it. I always loved it. I always, when I was growing up, radio was still king. You still heard, the kind of the Spanish version of the Long Ranger or the soap operas, the adventure stories. All your major sports were on the radio, whether it was a big boxing match, Alexis Arguello, or the Nicaraguan team playing Cuba in the 1972 amateur world championships, or what have you. They were on the radio. You only had two channels of television. If you would get, let's say, the game of the week, it would be delayed 1 or 2 weeks, tape delayed. So most of your things were on the radio, and I love sports. So Dad and I would listen to the radio because everything, whether you would go storefront to storefront and you would listen to the radio. So I knew I loved the radio, I loved sports, but I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get there. But he says, well, how are you going to get there? Well, that's what I thought, same thing. And I'm not going to be able to make any money at this. Well, as it turned out, I wanted to be a computer geek because I was just looking at how much money it was just starting then. A computer was, 3x5 cards and so forth.
Yep.
But I said, this is not. So Mom says, you like the radio, you don't like the computer. If you really want to go for it, we'll back you. We'll do something. So I got to Florida College, and I started writing a column in the paper for the school paper. And then, as it turned out, the baseball coach, Dave Scott, had played in Nicaragua with one of the all-star outfits that had gone from Miami with a couple of major league scouts, Julio Blanco Herrera, and a couple other guys. But so he's the head baseball coach, and we're talking. And I don't know, I stumbled onto him because another player, his dad had played in Nicaragua. So I don't know, somehow we end up meeting, and we're exchanging stories when he went to Nicaragua, when he was really an assistant coach, but he had to pitch one time, and that we were talking about the rainout that they had, they should have had, but they didn't have it because the guy with the money, whatever was paid to this, was already gone. So you had to have the game. And it was raining, so they had to, put sand, really roll down the field with a lot of sand, a lot of a sand mill from up. So, I mean, it was a lot of, to dry up the field. So it was a late game all the way into the late hours of the night. So we're talking about that game. So I tell Coach Scott that I don't like the PA announcer that he has. And it's okay, let's see what we can do. So he asks his players, will you mind a blind guy calling the PA announcer? No. And because they thought they liked me enough, and that's how I got really the start.
Yeah.
And then somehow I was too busy doing the baseball PA and writing columns, I forgot that I had to study. So I get put on academic probation. I go home to Nicaragua, and I start banging the door, and Mom and Dad know this guy that owns the station, still owns the one of the major stations in Nicaragua, Fabio Gadea. So I get there, and I become a little volunteer stringer. And that's when, I guess, the passion that I thought, I can do this. And, I guess that's where it all started, Florida College.
And so as far as actually getting into, radio booths and kind of the radio side of things, what was your first introduction to that?
Well, I always was, as a little kid, somebody would take me up to the booth. And I would sit with the booth with the big-time announcers in Nicaragua. Or if somebody, a friend of mine who's passed away a long time ago, would take me to Reds. But, I wouldn't get into the booth then. But, after a while, I started going into the booth. But I guess in Nicaragua, where I began, you know, just sitting up in the booth with these guys. Loved it. He would sit the whole game. The people that were with me would sit down. They didn't care about going up to the booth, but I did. So I could hear them.
Yeah.
And it was fun. And they said, well, it's going to be fun. But then I guess finally when I get out of USF and I have to start, you know, doing something, I start covering stuff for free, whatever. So I go to this radio station, WQBN 1300 back then. And this gentleman, who's still alive, Pooley Sakara, who's a musician, program director, he says, you look like you know your stuff. And so he asked me a couple questions. I said, let's go. So he gives me a chance to be part of the sports staff, volunteer basis. But I was just happy at that point to just go and cover. You know, go. I can't believe they're letting me get in for free. All right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't mind that. I get in to meet all some of my heroes and get to go cover stuff. I get to go cover tennis. Though that was the one and only tournament I covered. I couldn't take the umpire telling me to be quiet. I was talking to my spotter all through the ball. And he didn't like it. And, well, I mean, this was 1988, 89. I mean, so then, as it turned out, I'm doing the sports talk and I'm covering everything. I mean, I'm just going to the boxing matches. I'm going to whatever. I mean, I'm going to see the Beast Mugabe, who was fighting out of Tampa. Got a chance to interview the late fight doctor, Ferdy Pacheco, and stuff like that. And so I'm just going around. And finally, all of these teams, you know, thinking about moving. But before anything happens, Jim Morley decides to put together the Senior Professional Baseball League, which is all stars, you know, like Ron LaFleur, George Foster, and Ossie Virgil, and so forth. And so St. Pete Pelicans become the Tampa team, and they get the station that I'm at, where I'm doing sports, gets the rights. We're going to do 20 games, 20 home games. And as it turned out, the guys at the station liked me enough that we went to do the games. You know, so I did 20 games, not a whole lot of money, if any, but it was fun to meet, again, George Foster, have Tom Jones writing one of my first stories, you know, out of the booth, that he wrote a story,
yeah,
you know, on me when I was covering the Pelicans. And that's how I started, with the Pelicans, and then doing a little stunt, part of Ripley's reopening up in St. Augustine. Somebody brought me up, and I was up there doing a half inning of play-by-play and 3 innings of color with Mark Hauser. So that was an interesting thing. So after that, you know, nothing happens. You're still banging around, covering things, making a little money. Meanwhile, bills have to be paid. So mom's working at the public defender, and I interviewed for a job there. And I've been there, you know, 28 years. But anyway, so I keep going. And so finally, after many fights with Major League Baseball, Tampa gets a team. And when they get the team, a longtime friend of mine from Florida College, Orestes Estrada, becomes their community development. He's put in charge of finding the staff and the radio station. So he finds it, and he considers me, and he says, I know you. I want to put you in there. I think you can do this. So they go up to Mr. Namoli, and they say, well, we got the perfect announcer, but the only drawback, he can't see. So Vince kind of hesitated, but due to the fact that Rick Vaughn and Orestes had, you know, track records of knowing what they're saying, they decided to give me a chance, and I guess the rest is history.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it shows, you know, just that one or two recommendations and how much that weight can carry, you know, for somebody else is really powerful.
Well, you need, especially now, I wish people would understand that it's even more important now. As Ken Coleman, now Ramsey's personality, has a book out, The Proximity Principle, where you have to get network yourself to, because you never know. I mean, you can't just go in there and because you want something for you, but, you know, you just never know. A friendship, who would have thought that a friendship from 1981 would have paid dividends later after he had retired from the game, you know, where he played for the Marlins, the Pirates, the Yankees a little bit, and the Japanese, you know, for the Cebu Lions.
Right.
But those are the things that always, that you never know. If you meet somebody, you never know who that guy is that opens the door. Because somebody has to open it. I don't care if you're blind or sight or otherwise.
Somebody
has to open it.
Absolutely, yeah. And I myself, as a visually impaired person, can absolutely attest to the challenges and everything that goes into finding, you know, work, especially full-time work. And so, you know, it definitely sounds like your persistence just and making those connections, and even for many years past, really paid off.
Yeah, well, you have to, Greg. I mean, nothing, as my dad would have said, you better resolve. You know, nobody's going to care if you're blind or not, especially for you. You have to really push because it's hard.
No doubt.
Fortunately for me, there's a kid that is trying to follow my footsteps, Trent Ferguson, who is a recent graduate of the FSDB 2017, who's already doing the college game of the week on, you know, high school game of the week on for Flagler Group Radio up in St. Augustine, up in Flagler Palm Coast, some updates around his, you know, Avon Park and so forth.
Yeah, I do remember reading a story about him. So another, you know, it sounds like there's another one potential here on the way for some big things. So then as far as the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, I know their first game was March 31st, 1998. And talk to me about that experience of being in the broadcast booth, you know, for an expansion team, for a brand new team, the first game. What was that whole atmosphere like?
Well, it was amazing. A sold-out dome. Amazing. It's just... here I was, the dream fulfilled, sitting in the booth. Nobody can take this away. Something that you fought hard, and you got there. And here it is. You know, Wilson Alvarez throwing a strike to Brian Hunt. You know, the Tigers' leadoff hitter. And you'll never forget those things. You know, here's the, you know, you watch this, and you think of Fred McGriff at first base, Wade Boggs at third, and Wilson Alvarez would come up from the White Sox, Dave Martinez, you know, in right field against the Detroit Tigers. And you just say, well, I can't believe this. Here I am in the booth, calling this. And, you know, obviously it's amazing.
Right. One of those pinch yourself type moments, it sounds like.
I can't believe this. Is it really happening?
Yeah. And I'm curious, just fast forwarding kind of briefly here, did you expect, you know, to be with this team for this many years later now?
Well, you expect to try to do it as long as they can. And I thought it might be this long. Who knows? I just knew that I liked to do it.
Right.
And as long as they wanted me there, I liked that I was going to be there. 20 years, I don't know. You can't predict tomorrow. So it's pretty hard to say, but that I could see myself... that I would like to do this for 20 years, yeah.
Let's talk about your preparation for a game, for a series, you know, when the season is going on. What's your kind of day-to-day life like during the baseball season?
Well, during the baseball season, for the baseball season, we get the two big books, the scouting notebook and the prospect book. Because we look at, you know, each team's prospects, each team's players. So we start, I don't know, four or five series to start the year. And, you know, go over each and every player, what they're like, what they're saying, you know, what scouts say about them or what have you. So, you know, you prepare yourself that way. And then as the season goes, fortunately, my wife will read a bunch of papers, columns, and she'll send me stuff like from The Athletic or, you know, from our paper, from their paper. And then if I get to the stadium early enough for my other job, I go and talk to the opposition announcers. Because they follow that team better than I do from the standpoint they see it every day. So then you talk to a coach, maybe you talk to a broadcaster, and then you look at, you know, the lineup, and then you read some of the pregame notes that Dan reads for me and so forth, and then, you know, all the articles that you've read. Maybe there's an article on somebody that I should read, you know, from their local paper, or from The Athletic. I have a subscription to The Athletic, and now it comes on your phone, so you can, you know, read it. Or a Bleacher Report, or you know, our own MLB guy.
Right.
So all this stuff that you have to cover.
And as far as actually consuming all the content, do you find the sites, the apps, to be pretty accessible for what you need to do?
Some of them are not, because you have to move the phone, and it's kind of slow, you know, arduous reading. Dev could read it a lot faster than I can move my hands to the phone. I mean, to get to the apps, no problem.
Yeah.
To move it and read the article within the apps, a little more difficult.
I see. And I know you have mentioned your wife, Debbie. Talk to me about her role and kind of how she's been able to help you.
Well, she takes me to the game. If I ask her to give me a player, she'll take me to him, or she'll find them for me and, you know, try to get me. Or if I'm doing something else, she'll try to get them to hold on and wait for me. And then she's reading. She's always looking at stats during the game, whether it's, you know, updating stats during the game. We'll have it on MLB Network, you know, on the iPad, the iPad, and we'll have different things. We have our phones going for Twitters and all kinds of stuff, and she reads those. There's no way I can have my phone firing, you know, and talking during the broadcast.
Right.
So she looks at all that stuff during the broadcast. Like anybody else. I mean, they have staff that looks at all this stuff and hands it to them. But the only difference is Dev has to tell me.
Right. I see. And I assume you've kind of, you know, come up with a system so she's not, say, interrupting the broadcast, obviously, or not.
She knows.
Yeah. I'm also curious about, you know, your sense of sound and how you kind of perceive sound, say, you know, during a baseball game.
The bat says a lot, the gloves, you hear the, sometimes you might hear, because you have a parabolic antenna, you know, a parabolic mic down there, so you can hear the glove, or the fans say a lot, you know, about what's happening. The fans say a lot.
True. Yeah. And I'll say, as a baseball fan myself, I know in general I can kind of get a sense of what's going on based on fan reaction. But I know, let's say the Yankees are playing the Rays or the Red Sox, or, you know, a team that might have a larger following and maybe a larger fandom that's at the game. Sometimes I'm kind of thinking, okay, there's cheering going on, but yet it's not for the Rays.
Or... if I went to a Maple Leafs Lightning game last year. And there were a lot of people from Toronto here, and they kind of threw me off.
Yeah, I can definitely relate. Yeah. And then as far as your interactions with the players, coaches, I'm curious, how have those interactions been?
Well, in the beginning, they were kind of like, but now they know you. And most of those guys are pretty nice, and they are willing to give you the time of day. And players, they kind of know who you are now. And most of them will give you, you know, talk to you because they know that you're not just a freak of nature, that you actually go and do your job.
Right. I know I was also reading a piece, I think in the LA Times, that talked about how Joe Maddon, you know, the former Tampa Bay Rays manager, I guess he and you were, you know, conversing, interacting, and he actually kind of physically demonstrated a pitching sequence. Do you recall that?
Yeah. Well, we always demonstrated stuff. Joe was always good about that. Talked about different pitches, different, you know, what it was and why it was. Can't remember what pitching sequence, but we always talked about that. Our base running and different things. Or we talk about bat, like putting your foot count and tapping it too many times. There's so many things that Joe and I would discuss that are not, you know, that to think about one in particular, that would be tough. Because we would talk about books, we'd talk about music, anything.
Yeah. But it sounds like he was, you know, maybe even a little extra helpful and whatnot, and really communicating.
Whether it's my math teacher at the blind school, most of those guys are. If you ask them something, they're nice about walking you through. Charlie Montoya, any of these guys.
And talk about Kevin Cash. How have your interactions been with him?
He's a nice guy, but, you know, I talked to him, but he doesn't speak Spanish, so it's really, I mean, I could interview him. We keep talking about interviewing him, but it's, I would have to translate them, which I can. It's just that Kevin's always been nice. When he was the bullpen coach at Cleveland, I did interview him for the radio, for the Spanish broadcast. So he's, you know, Kevin's a nice guy.
As far as I know, Ricardo Tavares has been a long time, you know, play-by-play man.
Yeah, like last 14 years.
Right, your partner in the booth. Talk to me about your relationship with Ricardo.
Well, it's a good relationship. We know what he wants, and I know how to follow him because Ricky's kind of the fun guy to be with, you know, so you have to figure out where he's going. And he's, you know, opens up the mic for me to roll. No inhibition. So we get along rather well, and we, you know, we've been doing this for a while. We genuinely get along very well, so that's always helpful. And Ricky knows to go back and forth, and that's the thing. So he's, you know, been my partner for 15 years, and it's great.
And then in terms of, you know, the actual commentary, what you actually are communicating on the air, from what I understand, it's, you know, you certainly do a ton of research, and obviously, you know, we've talked about sound, and I'm sure just having, you know, Ricky describe plays,
yeah,
and kind of
how excited he gets or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like you guys play off and complement each other pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. You have to.
Right.
You have a disjointed broadcast, whether it's us and the Spanish or the English guys. You just can't have two broadcasts going different ways.
Absolutely, yeah. I know I did have a chance to go up in your booth one time, and I could really sense the joy and energy and enthusiasm that you two have there.
It's fun, that's for sure. And then when you get to meet somebody in other realms of life, like Icky V, you know, Dick Vitale, who season tickets for the Rays, or you get to meet some of your heroes like Marv Albert or Bob Costas, who I had a chance to meet last year. So you get to meet your heroes, and all of a sudden, okay, it's amazing. Whatever walk of life it is.
Absolutely.
I mean, I got to meet Mark Anthony last year down in the fields. He was, you know, watching batting practice.
And then as far as the Rays, their 2008 run into the World Series, can you kind of maybe talk about that experience, what that all was like, especially
that
playoff
amazing.
Run?
I've never seen anything like it where all these journalists were around. And this guy pops up to me, and I don't know, he's writing a story. And I was, all of a sudden, I'm walking to try to get somebody, to try to get a player, and he's talking to me, asking me questions. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the thing, he tells me, oh, I just got the Associated Press to print this story. So I'm working on this story. And it's, you know, you have all these guys, you know, Tim Kirchin, you meet all the press, the different people that for the 2008 run. It's just not like, it's nothing, you know, where you have all the celebrities, all this, it's amazing. I mean, it was just an amazing run, long and arduous, but, you know, it was an amazing run.
Definitely, no question. And then I understand you also, in addition to, you know, your full-time broadcasting duties, you do some translation work as well, if
yeah,
you could talk about that.
Yeah, I'm a translator for the Public Defender, the Spanish interpreter. So that takes me every day to the courthouse in Tampa, where you know, I try to help our Hispanic people communicate with their attorneys.
And have you done that pretty much as long as you've been with the Rays?
Yes, longer. 20
longer.
Years.
Oh, really? Wow. So that's during the season, that's got to be a lot to juggle.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, you get used to it after a while.
Right.
And, you know, part of the daily grind. They'll tell you the truth, when it gets to about mid-season, oh, the All-Star break can't come fast enough.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then
especially if you had three 8 o'clock games, you know, in a row.
True.
There's a rain delay, so the game doesn't start until 9:30. So that's
exactly. Yeah. And then do you occasionally travel with the team? Is that kind of the schedule?
No, that's we do it from our booth.
Just the home games, right?
Well, we do the home games and the road games.
Okay.
But we do them from our booth.
Oh, I see. And I know
an empty stadium, which is an interesting thing.
yeah, that's, I did not know that. That's, is it kind of tough kind of getting the energy going without fans there?
You get used to it.
Yeah.
You get used to it. For me, I always imagine as a kid anyway, did fake make-believe radio on a tape recorder. So that's, unfortunately for us, we hook up to the sound, the ambiance of the game does come from the stadium where we are. Because we'll call up a coupler at the stadium. And the fans feel from Yankee Stadium or Boston or whomever. So it's not that. So that makes it better. If it was on a continuous pool type of fans, yeah, that would be tough.
Yeah, yeah, wow. So at least you do get some feel and sense of the game with the sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know you also have done some work with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the Tampa Bay Storm.
Two seasons of the Bucs and two seasons of the Storm. So yeah, that was different. That was a interesting rate. That was interesting because football's a whole different sport.
Right. As far as, say, your preparation, is it any different for a football game?
Yes, it is, because you have a whole week to do that.
Right.
So you get pamphlets from each team, and then you just go through the week of preparing. And there's more shows that you can watch. When I was doing the football game, probably one of my favorite shows it was sponsored by Edge at that point. It was called the Edge NFL Matchups, where they talked about formations and different things, big key games that would take formations and talk about those formations. So that's a different thing, you know, where you watch the different, but you could get, you know, you could start preparing a whole week for that.
Yeah.
For Crescendo on Sunday.
And did I read that you were with the Bucks their Super Bowl year?
Yeah. That was the year we did them, 2002 and then 2003.
Wow. And I'm sure just, you know, being in the broadcast booth, the pace of the game is quite different and just the whole feel.
Well, it is. Totally different. You can't tell stories because the play's moving.
Right.
So you got to talk about the game itself. Can't tell stories.
Yeah. Would you say it's maybe a little more challenging as far as a color commentator goes compared to baseball?
Not really. It's different.
Yeah.
Because you're more into telling stories. Here, you better understand what the game is. And so you have to really understand what the game plan is for that particular game. Because if you understand what the game plan, the rest of it kind of falls in place.
True. Yeah.
And again, I would have talked to, at that time, the Rams would have come into town. I would have gone over there to talk to Jack Snow and Steve Sabrisky, or the Panthers, Eugene Robinson, or, you know, let's say Marv Albert came in for football, or even Boomer a little bit, you know, from NFL football at that time. Or, yeah, you talk to the opposition. And you know, and if you get lucky enough, you talk to Troy Aikman, you know. Or Brian Bollinger for Fox, whatever. You would talk to different people.
Yeah. So it sounds like the broadcasters, your fellow broadcasters, really are great sources of information and insight.
Well, yeah, especially, you know, of course. You know, they're always nice. And, well, they are, because they have a chance to follow, you know, they've been around the game for a long time, whether it's a play-by-play guy or an analyst. You know, so that's what happens.
Sure, yeah. All right, so to wrap up here, I did want to ask you, you know, if there are, say, any blind and visually impaired individuals out there who are very passionate about sports and potentially even broadcasting, what kind of advice would you give to someone that would like to pursue a similar career?
Keep banging on the doors and never give up, because it's going to be tough. It's really tough, but especially nowadays where it's not as many outlets. You know, before it was a lot of smaller organizations, a lot of smaller radio stations. You know, now everybody's part of a group, whether it's CBS, Beasley, or what have you. So you just have to, hopefully somebody gives you a chance starting in high school and keep going forward after that.
Very well said. All right. Well, again, I definitely want to thank you for your time, Enrique.
Thank you, Greg.
It's been a true pleasure, and really appreciate you coming on and giving your time.
Be sure to follow the Eyes Free Sports podcast at facebook.com/eyesfreesports and on Twitter @eyesfreesports.